Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By Premium Plus Sports, the best travel agency around. By USA-swimrun.com. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've now been around 25 years, sent out 23,000 grants, and have raised over $100 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here. And speaking of endurance, there is nobody who's a tougher endurance athlete than this young man who is joining us next. His new book, Can't Hurt Me, Master Your Mind and Defy the Odds. We go way, way back to the very beginning of this journey. It's David Goggins joining us. David, it has been way too long.
Bob, it has been. It's been a real long time, man.
So what's fun is I look back and I remember hearing, okay, this guy wanted to do, he realized that August 2005, he's weighing 285 pounds, powerlifting, and making a decision as a Navy SEAL already that I need to do something to, one, change my life. I want to lose some weight, but I also want to get into something that a little bit out of my comfort zone, endurance and running. At 285 pounds, what led you to go to running?
Well, there was an incident that happened, and I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with it, called the called Lone Survivor.
Yes.
It was Operation Red Wings, and a bunch of SEALs were up there. You know, there's four SEALs up on, you know, just doing some reconnaissance, you know, looking at, you know, some different things, whatever's going on. And basically, they got overrun.
Right.
And almost all of them died. Mark Citrell lived. Mark Citrell's a good buddy of mine, along with all the other guys up on that mountainside. And a QRF team came in to save them. A quick reaction force team came in to save them. And they got blown out of the sky.
Yes.
So everybody died besides Marcus. And that's when I, you know, decided to do something about it. And, you know, not being real smart about it, I wasn't an endurance athlete at all. I decided to look up the 10 hardest races in the world. And, you know, it wasn't 5Ks and 10Ks. It was a race called the Badwater 135.
Oh, yeah. Our buddy Chris Cospin's event. Running across Death Valley in July, 120 degrees. But you can't just go, okay, I'm David Goggins, I'm going to sign up for this event. You got to go qualify, right?
Yeah.
You've got to run 100 miles in under 24 hours. And
right.
Again, you're weighing 285 pounds and know nothing about nutrition for this stuff. You're on
right.
Ritz crackers and Myoplex, if I remember correctly. And
right.
It's a one-mile loop that you run over and over again. And you run, I think it took you 18, 19 hours to run 100 miles, but you broke, what, every bone in your foot?
Yeah, so I broke almost every metatarsal in my feet. When I got done with the race, I was trying to go to the bathroom. And I have all this really, really detailed in the book. But
right.
At mile 100, I got done at mile 101. So I went to the bathroom myself at mile 70, you know, very lightly.
Yes.
And then at mile 101, it was just a daggone destruction. My blood pressure was messed up. I couldn't stand up. I was trying to make it to the porta potty, and I just couldn't get up. So I literally just sat there in that chair and went to the bathroom myself, peeing blood down my leg and crapping up my back. It was quite interesting.
So what's fascinating to me is usually people, I interview a lot of people, they weigh a lot. They weigh a lot. They decide they're going to turn their life around by doing running. And then they lose a little weight and they go, oh, I had this run the other day where I had this, I had the runner's high. I felt great. I loved it. I don't think you've still ever had that, where you hate every second of that. Was the thing that always intrigued me. It's like, oh, David, you hated running in the beginning, but you must love it now. It's like, no, sir, I never have enjoyed one step of it. I do it for the suffering.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, now you've read, you know, the first chapter or so of the book, so now you're starting to understand where some of the mentality comes from. So, you know, I was coming up the way I came up, I was a really abused kid growing up as far as my father was concerned. And then I moved to a very small town in Indiana where a lot of people were very good, but a lot of people were bad. It was near Center Point, and Center Point was a main hub for the KKK.
Yeah.
So I was tortured as a kid. You know, torture is a good word for it, as a kid. So it really brought I had a lot of insecurities. I suffered severely bad with trying to be accepted. And what happened with me was I had to learn how to callous my mind. I really had to learn how to harden up, because so the person that you know of, Bob,
right,
who jumps on planes, runs these miles, this is a self-made person. This isn't the person that I used to be. So in self-making myself, I had to really start finding things that made me uncomfortable, because I realized, and this is before the whole mental toughness craze came out. You know, I didn't know what the hell mental toughness was. You know, I didn't know all this crap. I just knew that I had to start doing things that really sucked. And basically what I did was I started inventing these programs of, okay, whatever sucks, we're going to do, whatever makes you like, you know, we all know, cause our mind has the tactical advantage. It knows what you don't want to do, and it kind of guides you from that. So whenever it would come to running or any kind of cardiovascular activity, my mind would say, hey, let's go lift weights. Lift weights is better. So, but I found out by doing that, I never got any better. I never got stronger. My mind stayed weak, and I had to strengthen this mind. So that's exactly how it all started, and it kind of snowballed into, you know, I got to get harder. I got to get harder. I got to find more. I got to be uncommon amongst uncommon people, and that's kind of how it happened. And I started, you know, getting harder through doing things that I just don't like doing.
Again, the book is called Can't Hurt Me, Master Your Mind, Defy the Odds. And the warning order in the book, right, basically says, you know, the mission for all the readers is to break free of all boundaries, real and imagined, accept your life completely, ditch the victim's mentality forever, reclaim your power, improve your life in all aspects, and become a hard MF-er. You know, and then read this book cover to cover, which I've read the first chapter and couldn't. I was like, where's the rest of this? I need to read the rest of this. Study the techniques within, accept all 10 challenges, repeat until free. And when I read this first chapter and about the horrific, here you go from the family had seemingly everything while you're in a suburb of Buffalo. But I love the fact that, was it Paradise Street that you lived on?
Yeah,
you live on Paradise Street,
yes.
And you're getting beat. You're beat with a belt. Your dad's like pulling a gun on your mom. You're working at a skate rink until all hours of the night. Your dad and mom are at this bar upstairs of the skate rink. Your life was horrific, and then you escape from Paradise to go to a place was basically the home of the KKK. So, I didn't know any of that. All I saw was the byproduct. I saw the byproduct of, here, I'm going to go do this 100-mile thing because it's the baddest thing around, and I need to suffer. And then you go to Badwater, and you finish fifth, your first time there, and everybody's like, who the heck is this guy? And then, I think I'll now you're into this, and you do a triathlon. Oh, well, is he going to do a sprint? Is he going to do Olympic? No, he's going to do Ultraman. He's going to do a three-day triathlon. starts with a 10K swim, followed by 90-mile bike with about 7,000 feet of climbing, then 171-mile bike the next day, And, oh, by the way, I'll borrow a bike. I break the front wheel. I have a bike now that I can't even put bike shoes on. I'm using flat pedals. And then the last day you run back for our listeners. You're running from Javi, which a lot of our folks have ridden to. You're running a double marathon back to Kona. And right. Then over that next number of years, you're just every week you're running another 100 miler and breaking world records in 48 hours and 200 miles in 48 hours. Was it just, I need to suffer more? I need to. Obviously, the charity is there and you're raising money for the families that lost loved ones in the SEALs. But the fact that you were doing so much of this, was right. that just you feeling like I need to suffer? I need to hurt myself?
You know what, Bob? At first, it was never about that. What it became was, I thought after I went through, I was in 3 whole weeks and whatnot, but after all that stuff I did in the military, and I did that first 100-mile race almost just by chance. It was just by chance, honestly. I didn't know that that word even existed, but what happened was I was so underprepared for that race that 19 hours it took me to run 101 miles on a flat track, literally, it changed my life. It wasn't Navy SEAL training. It wasn't anything. It literally changed my life because it pushed me to a level that I thought was humanly impossible. And I had to pull everything out of the cookie jar, out of my mental cookie jar. I had to sit back and do all these. So I went through a lifetime in 19 hours. So most of us, all the highs and lows of life and all the depression and then you have a high point and a low point. I went through a full lifetime in 19 hours. And what I discovered at the end of all this was I discovered a whole David Goggins that I never knew existed. And so on the other side of suffering, I realized that there was a whole other world that many people had never even tapped into. Had never, and that's when I realized that my life really started. And that's what really messed me up. Because I'm like, man, oh, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm this, I'm that. I'm over, Ranger school and all this crap I've done. I learned how to read when I was a junior in high school, pretty much. You didn't get to that far yet in the book, Bob.
No, so, I know. But yeah,
So anyway, all this stuff was flashed. And so I'm laying in the tub after this 101 miles I did, and my ex-wife, she's not my ex-wife now. I'm in the tub and I'm peeing this dirt out of me, and it looks it's blood and dirt. It's the nastiest thing to come out of me, and I was the worst pain of my life. My feet were broken, my chin stretch fractures, everything. And she puts the water on me, and she was a nurse, and she's scared to death. And I'm sitting there thinking, my God, I am the most jacked up I've been in my life, but it is the best feeling I've ever had. Because what? I had to find so much that all that pain that I was going through was confirmation that I found a whole new world in my mind. And most people who are probably hearing this thing, this guy's freaking nuts. But it's just the truth of the matter, and that's how all that started. It just started like, man, like there's so much more behind. It's not the race. It wasn't winning. It wasn't the trophy. And whenever I got caught up in the race, whenever I got caught up in the winning, that's when things got bad for me. Whenever I got caught up in the competition of the race versus the competition of Goggins.
So when you started thinking about, I finished fifth. Now I can finish third at Badwater. Maybe I can win. That wasn't the purpose. That was secondary.
Right, that was never the purpose. And when I lost focus of why I was doing it, that's when racing became racing versus I'm finding more. And that's when it just and that's when it went downhill until I got refocused again.
The other just a couple of points that really hit home to me is you had your dad was a guy who was always smiling. And on the outside, people would go, oh, my God, what a good guy. He smiled. You learned a lot from that. The fact that people could be smiling at you, and you look at them and go, I'm not. Most of us, we see somebody smiling and happy, we trust them. But
right.
to David Goggins, You learned early on that smile doesn't necessarily mean authentic. That doesn't mean anything except for be wary.
Right. Right. Yeah, that became my whole, you know, that actually became my whole mantra. It's like show no weakness.
Yeah.
But the whole thing about that was, yeah, I live with a man every day of his life that, you know, to the public outside that, you know, that house on, you know, 201 Paradise Road.
Paradise Road.
Yeah, 201 Paradise Road, man, in Buffalo, New York. He was just the best guy in the world.
Right.
And the second those doors would shut and it was me, my mom, and my brother, you know, he was a severe alcoholic. He was pretty much the pimp of Buffalo, New York. And it was game on, you know, game on. I remember, and I think you probably read this part, where my dad beat the hell out of my mom and then drug her down the stairs by her hair.
Right. And you jumped at him.
Right. And I jumped on him, and I couldn't go to school for several days after that because he beat the living hell out of me. And what that does to a kid is it scars your brain. And this isn't like one episode.
No.
This was almost a daily thing, and it starts to scar your brain. And the foundation that I had was so broken that when I did move to, you know, that small town in Brazil, Indiana, you know, I wasn't prepared for, and on top of that, I had a severe learning disability because I had a very toxic brain. So, you know, my brain was toxic. So just learning coming from that environment, going to a pretty much healthy environment, my mind wasn't ready for any of that. So that smile you wear is, you know, people can definitely fool you.
Well, here you got a smile from the dad. Then you've got this beautiful home, right? And to the outside, everything looks perfect. And right. But it's all a fallacy. Because inside, you're living in hell. And just I can't even imagine a dad telling his son, you know, when we get home, you need to get naked. So that you're, and then the anticipation that you're just laying there on your bed knowing that at some point in time, it could be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, he's going to go drink, do whatever hell, he's going to come and beat the living crap out of you.
And in that scene you're talking about right there, it was probably about 45 to an hour. So what he did well was he was a very – so I'm really into figuring out your enemy.
Yes.
You know, a lot of us freak out. You know, we think it's us. You know, we think someone's against us. We think all these things. What I learned at a young age is that you have to figure out your enemy because a lot of times it's not really about you. Even though you get involved in their mess – And their mess could be their childhood, whatever's going on. You know, my dad would really do a whole bunch of tactical things to make you suffer before the suffering even started. So his big thing was he had you go upstairs, take your clothes off, and lay across the bed with your feet, you know, like at a 90-degree angle with your legs hanging off. And he shut the lights out, door shut. And your back would face the door where you come in at. And, you know, you had no idea when it was coming. But you just laid there knowing it was coming. It was coming from all angles. And there'd be times when, you know, it was just nuts. It was such a tactical warfare. But that was the whole thing I learned about this guy was he was suffering so bad in his mind from different things that happened to him or whatever that he just became, he just became a bully. He became a bully and he took it out on the people around him, you know, the ones closest to him.
So David, what do you want people to come away from the book with? It's funny, when first setting up the interview, I'm thinking, okay, cool, we're going to talk. It's a 10-year anniversary of David jumping out of a plane, out of parachuting into the bay at the 2008 Ironman and going, you know, 11 hours. And all that stuff seems so immaterial. All that, you know, all the 100-mile runs and up at altitude and all that crap. I look at that now and I go, like, that was the surface stuff that we saw. The stuff that drove you when you came up with the concept of the book, what do you want people to get from it?
So when I came up with Can't Hurt Me, it's a lot of things. You know, so life, what I realized was I was my worst enemy. And a lot of times, a lot of us, you know, we don't want to share. Like, for instance, I didn't want to share my story with anybody.
Right.
I was so embarrassed for the fact that I stuttered for a long time. Patches of hair fell out. I had white splotches all over my face. I was, you know, I couldn't read. They wanted to put me in a special school, you know. And so I started cheating. You know, I cheated on every single assignment, you know, all into my junior year because I didn't want to be, you know, titled as special or I had to go to special school. So I didn't want to share it with people. I wanted people to know, hey, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm an endurance athlete. So a lot of us try to hide who we are through different things, through, you know, working out. Like, for instance, I became 300 pounds because why? Before I went to the Navy SEAL, I had to lose 106 pounds. I became big, not just for depression. I became big to hide. So the real me is about 175, 185 pounds. I'm not a big guy. But I figured if I became really big, I could hide. I could put this small guy in a big body and nobody's going to mess with me. Because I was a very insecure, scared kid. You know, and that's what life made me. So what Can't Hurt Me became, this book Can't Hurt Me, is I realized I have to be able to face myself. All these things that the world put on me, all the things, and a lot of things the world didn't put on me. A lot of things I put on myself. A lot of things, you start to create a reality that is not true. You know, our mind is the most powerful thing in the world. And until you master your mind, everything external will control you. So I had to. So the one thing that I feared, and I believe anything you fear in life, you have to learn to master it. I feared myself. I feared my own mind. My mind controlled me. So I became a master of my own mind because I wanted to defeat the very thing that was defeating me, which was my mind. Hmm. And it defeats all of us. Everybody is defeated by one thing, not defeated by your challenger. You are defeated before you even get to the start line, and the start line is not a race. The start line is you. So I realized that, and I dove deep on that. And the book is based, so there's a lot of books out there on, I hate to say the word mental toughness because it's so played out nowadays. Mental toughness is a habit, and a lot of people have these books, and it's a five-step book about, hey, this is five steps on how to become mentally tough. Or how to be better. It's a bunch of crap. You know, like they talk about self-talk. But self-talk is nothing until you realize you have to put work in. You have to put the work in to get the self-talk, because self-talk is nothing but a lie unless you put the work in. Because that's all I'm doing in self-talk is going back into all the hours and days and years I put into getting to that one moment. And all I'm doing is going back and pulling up all those minutes and hours I put into training to get to that one moment. So that's what this is about. It is about figuring out how your mind works. Like 3.14 is pi. It's an equation to figure out, you know, how to figure out different mathematical equations. So we all have, each individual in life is not cookie cutter. We all have a different equation on what makes us tick. What this book does, it gives you tactics on how to figure yourself out. What's going on in your own mind so you can figure out your own 3.14 to figure yourself out, because this isn't a cookie cutter. You know, mental toughness is not cookie cutter. You got to figure yourself out. Figure out what makes you tick. And that's what this book's all about.
Could you have written this book 10 years ago? Were you at a place that, because you were still going through it then, right? You were still pushing. And trying to find out what your limits were.
No, I could not have written this book 10 years ago. It took me, so another thing you don't know, Bob, and I won't talk about it too long, but I hit a point in my life about 5 or 6 years ago where I couldn't even get out of bed.
Really?
Yeah, so I couldn't run. I went from running 205 miles to I couldn't get out of bed. And so I'll give you the quick down and dirty. So through my whole life, as you're starting to read now, you know, so from the time I was born until about 6 years ago, now I'm 43, and I got in my late 30s, you know, and I also had two heart surgeries. I don't know if you know about the two heart surgeries.
You know what's so funny about that is here you are. You went in for, I think, a routine checkup. And they're
pretty
like,
much.
Right? And they're like, gosh, there's like, what, a hole in your heart, the issue with the heart. And I think
right.
the doctor said something, well, it's good that you have a desk job in the Navy because,
yeah.
and you're like, no, I'm a SEAL. I jump out of planes. And he's like, you do what?
Right.
he was blown away.
Surgery. Yeah, I was in surgery pretty quick and that didn't go well. It's another one. But then I got kind of better and I, went back to grind again. But So your whole life, all of us, a lot of us, especially now, we are living in fight or flight. So you're using your hip flexor muscles, your psoas. And if you don't know what psoas is, look it up.
Yeah.
It's a muscle that is pretty much controlled when you are in stress, fight or flight muscle. So my whole life, I've been using that muscle, and it attaches to your T12, which is, it's your spine. So I've been pretty much, that T12 been tightening and tightening and tightening. And over a long period of time, I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I didn't know what was happening. So my endocrine system started slowly shutting down and shutting down and shutting down. So they kept on giving me medication. So I kept on dropping out of these races. And the last race I dropped out of was the brand new Badwater that they did for 1 year. And I was like, man, I don't know what's going on. And so I went to the hospital, and they ran labs on me, and they're like, hey, your labs are fine. I'm like, man, there's something wrong. I started gaining weight, and I got to the point, man, where the doctors couldn't figure it out, so they had me on all kind of medications. And I was like, man, I think I'm dying. I mean, and they couldn't figure it out, so I laid in bed, and I couldn't go to work anymore. And I was lying to people at work why I couldn't go, the whole show no weakness crap. And in this period, it gave me a lot of time to reflect on my life. And in the reflection part of my life about how much I accomplished, because I never knew how much I accomplished. So in this reflection part of it all, I was going back through realizing, my God, man, I had done a lot. But I also realized, man, I'm probably going to die. So I just sat there and said, man, I can't do anything. I can't run. I can't work out. So I just said, well, what can I do? And I hadn't stretched out in years. And I couldn't ride a bike anymore because my back was so tight and I thought that I just had some slipped disc and stuff. No. The reason I couldn't ride a bike anymore is because that T12 was literally locking my back in, and my back would get so tight when I ride a bike. So I started stretching out. And I had these humongous lumps on the side of my or on my hip flexors. And basically, I just started stretching out and they started going away.
Huh.
But over a long period of time. And I had this humongous bump on the back of my head. And that started going down. And I noticed that bump from me shaving every day. And that started going down. And the more these bumps went down, the more the medication just wasn't working anymore. It actually started hurting me than helping me. So I would get off of one. And this wasn't under doctor care anymore. I was like doing all this on my own because, doctors kind of threw their hands up on me and said, we don't know what's wrong with you. So the more I stretched out, the more I opened my body up, the more I started realizing, I couldn't, I wasn't sleeping. I was a guy that never slept because my adrenal glands are so messed up, man. So I sleep about 2 hours a night, maybe 1 or 2 hours a night. And this is no exaggeration at all. This was like for years.
Wow.
And people go, man, how are you able to do this and that? I was like, man, I'm not tired. So I could run throughout the night. I could run, 39 hours and not get tired. So I started realizing that I locked my body up so bad. And this is just me. No doctor told me this. This isn't a doctor said this is what's wrong. This is what I came to believe over now that I'm now healthy, that my body was so locked up. And this is how, I started stretching out. It came to a point where I was stretching out, and this is no lie, 10 to 12 hours a night because I couldn't do anything else. So I would stretch out an hour and a half, 2 hours, take a break, go back to it. And I just, from the time I woke up, so when I started realizing that stretching was fixing me, and I became obsessed.
Well, that's a surprise.
I know, right? I became obsessed with stretching. And I was like, oh my God, man, I just tapped into the holy grail of fitness.
Yes.
And I realized that through yoga and fitness and, you know, or yoga and stretching and Pilates and all those other things, that full range of motion and opening up my hips and it did something. And I wasn't like tight. When people think, oh, you're just tight. No. My muscles had like gone out of place. Like they were like my body was out of whack. So another thing you don't know about me is for me to run, I had special inserts, and also I had to have these heel wedges because my body was so out of alignment that I had to wear all these different kind of contraptions and put different things in just to run because my body was so out of alignment. So no one knew any of this stuff. And so now I wear none of that crap. And so it just changed my life. So a guy who used to run 8:30 a mile at like a 140 some, you know, I was really big into heart rate training.
Yes.
So now, at the same heart rate, changing nothing but opening up my body, I run about a 7:10.
Wow. And you're older.
I'm older. Now I'm 43, and I was doing all this stuff in my early 30s, and I'm in the best shape of my life, and I'm just calm. I was really round, really tight.
Yes.
My body and my mind. So basically what my body was doing, it was choking me out from the inside. So my organs, where I believe there wasn't enough blood flow, and it was basically choking my organs out from just me being so tight. And that's just what I think, because now I'm off of all medications, and it's just from my body being opened up. So I talk about that a lot in my book, too, at the very end, at the last few chapters.
Do you think a lot of that is a byproduct of doing, what, 1,500-mile races over 2 years and just overdoing? Or do you think there was some other cause?
So I went back through. So when you write your book, you go back through to the beginning of it all. After my third hell week, so I was really big into powerlifting. You know, I gained all that weight. I was really big for Navy SEAL training. So I stopped going to the gym when I was in all these hell weeks and going through buds. When I got that last hell week and I got through training, I went back to the gym to go back to squat again. You know, I wanted to get back squatting again. I couldn't squat anymore. Huh. And I thought it was just because I slipped some discs and my hips were so freaking tight, I couldn't even put the bar. Just a normal 45-pound bar on my back and squat down.
Wow.
And that's when it started. So really, what no one knows about is that why I started running, yes, it was because of the incident that happened with the Navy SEALs, but that's all I could do. I couldn't lift weights as far as squatting. So my whole lower body, I couldn't do, but I could stand up and run. So I found things I could do. So once again, in hiding the fact that I was broken, because I knew they'd kick me out of the military, because that's when it started. Was it literally started? I believe it started somewhere in hell. I mean, I think it started when I was younger as a kid, just being tight and being afraid, and then going through buds, literally using that fight or flight muscle so much, that hip flexor muscle so much. Because you're not supposed to go through three hell weeks in 1 year.
No.
I mean, you're not supposed to go through one ever, let alone go through three. So in trying to find more, and I went through hell week, you know, with a broken body, that, you know, and then going through all the running, all the cycling, all that, that just really just decided, okay, now you're broken. Now we're going to really break you off. So, you know, that's it just, you know, all those miles and miles and miles and cycling miles. You know, I cycled.
Oh, 508. Yeah, yeah. All that stuff.
So it just kind of came to the point where my body said, okay, now you're done. Now you can't. Now you're done.
Wow. The other, there was another part of the chapter I read that I thought was pretty intriguing. So here you, the first teacher you had when you were in, I think that was when you were in Indiana.
Yes.
Worked with you, understood you, could see what your challenges were, and created success for you.
Right.
And then your next teacher wanted none of it, and basically made your life a living hell. And it makes you realize that you're the same kid. You didn't change, but one person was accepting, and the next person could care less. How did that affect you?
You know what? That is such a big thing you just said right there. And I hope people who read the book realize, you know, it's so big on the patience that we have with people.
Yeah.
Like for me, everybody learns very differently. And that woman you're talking about, her name is Sister Catherine. Sister Catherine was a, you know, she, I don't know if she's still alive or not, but she was a nun, or she is a nun, whatever. And she was very hardcore, man. She was so hardcore. And a lot of people look at hardcore as people being mean. No, I look at it very differently now. It's just how she was. And she had a lot of patience, but she knew that I needed repetition. And I talk about repetition now a lot in my book, about a lot of us, we quit way too early in life. We need reps. We need to put the reps in. On, you know, anything you do, you got to put the reps in. So that's just she knew that, yeah, this guy has learned this, you know, learned this ability. But I know that if we put the reps in on this kid, he's going to learn it. So she caught me up by, she was so hard on me that I couldn't stand her until I looked back and said, wow, she realized that I learned a certain way. So my next teacher, Mrs. D is what I call her, because I don't want to call her name out, because, you know, I'm not trying to get in trouble by calling her out. So Miss D in third grade, she was one that was about, you know, if you're not where you need to be, you don't need to be in my class. So that's when I started stuttering. And so all the hell from my childhood that I was trying to get over, that Miss D knew that, you know, she didn't know about the hell I went through. She didn't know that she was opening Pandora's box. And school was once a safe haven for me. It became hell for me.
Yeah.
So my mind, you know, now I'm like nine, right now in the third grade, my mind was like, oh my God, now anything that was yelling at me, anything that was torturing, anything that was impatience, it brought all this stuff to surface. So inside of me, man, I was stressed. I started stuttering, hair started falling out. I couldn't keep up with the class. And, you know, I was about to be, you know, put in a special school for kids that have learning disabilities. I started freaking out. You know, that patience that Miss, you know, that Sister Catherine had, Miss D didn't have. So I learned a lot by looking back on that time, that a lot of kids, you know, they are labeled. And they may, you know, maybe they shouldn't be labeled so quickly. You know, maybe we need to put a little more time into them. And nowadays, no one has any patience.
None.
We, you know, we all live in a world where, you know, we have to be keeping up with everybody, and we have no time for ourselves, and we wonder why we can achieve different goals, because our minds are so loud. There's so much going on inside our own minds that we have no quiet time, no time to think, no time to, you know, be patient with ourselves. So yeah, it's all very big. It's all very big.
Well, what I think is fascinating too is here your dad was the guy smiling all the time,
right,
and putting up that false front, and Sister Catherine wasn't a smiler. Right?
No.
But here's somebody who really cared. She cared about you and adapted to you and made sure she got the best out of you. She found what worked for you. And that had to be confusing to a kid. Here's dad is smiley, happy, everybody thinks he's great. And the other kids, nobody likes Sister Catherine, but she gets me and she understands how to get the best out of me.
That taught me a lot too. I don't judge people by how they look. I judge people on their actions.
Yep.
On their actions.
So when you've do all this endurance stuff for all these years, from the endurance side, what was the toughest thing you ever did? Toughest endurance event?
You know what? It's funny. I've done so many hard events. You know, I broke the Guinness Book of World Records for the most pull-ups. I know
3,000. Yes.
Yeah. 4,030 in, you know,
oh, that's
I did
right.
in 17 hours. Yeah, 4,030. So I want to be known more as an endurance athlete versus just a guy that ran.
Right.
So that was very difficult, but it always goes back to that first race. It always goes back to that first race, and it goes back to not being prepared.
At all.
At all. Literally, I called Chris Costin up on a Wednesday. And that Saturday, so 4 days later, three, four days later, I'm out on a track running 100 miles with, you know, with zero preparation. And even though it was a flat course with no hills, and you ran around a 1 mile track, it was the worst thing I'd ever done in my life, because running 100 miles is difficult, but when you train for it, you know, it's not as bad as it seems. But when you run 100 miles with zero training.
At 290 pounds.
Oh, and I went back, Bob, I was about 245, 250.
250, okay.
Yeah, around there, yeah. So I actually have a picture of me running with somebody, and I was in really good shape. I was like a bodybuilder. So I looked like a bodybuilder because I was doing nothing but muscle training. But I was doing no cardio. I was doing all weight training because I was very comfortable in the gym. You know, I was very comfortable with just being a big guy. So, that would go down as being, I was a big muscle-bound guy. And when you're a muscle-bound guy, that's even harder to run because you have no fat. So I'm out there just muscle-bound guy running 101 miles, and it sucked so bad.
Without any fuel, too. You're taking protein in rather than any type of fuel your body could use right now.
Right. Ritz crackers, for those endurance athletes who listen to the show, Ritz crackers and Myoplex is a horrible, horrible nutritional plan. I just didn't know, man. I had no idea.
So it's funny, when I heard you were self-publishing your book, I was not taken by surprise, because I remember back in the day, I was like, David needs a sponsor. We'll get, Under Armour's coming on. They're going to be a sponsor for David. He's going to go to Badwater. So I talked to Under Armour folks, are totally on board, to send you all sorts of cool gear. And then photos come back from Badwater. You're in that ratty tank top shirt, ripped up, and Under Armour like, what? He didn't wear any of our stuff. And I'm like, it's David Goggins. I could just see you sitting with a publisher and going, yeah, you can give me money, but you know what? I'd rather control my own destiny and do my own thing.
You know what's funny about that, Bob, is I sat there and I was, I've been writing this book for a while, man, and I knew I had a hit book. And the only reason why I knew that is because God put a lot of crap in front of me, and I had to overcome a lot. And I talked about this thing called, there's a bunch of theorists and there's a practitioner. I became a practitioner. So a lot of people write books about theory, about how the mind is supposed to work in situations. And that's all it is. You have some guy who hasn't really done it, who has done a study on some people, and then writes a book,
right,
about how the mind works. I'm a practitioner. I put myself in hell and dissected how the mind works in hell. And so it's an authentic way of how the mind really works when you're at the worst and you want to quit, when you're in the middle of suffering, whether it be physical or just mental. It just could be just trying to study for a test, or you have an abusive parent, or you have being bullied. The mind can take you to all kind of places. So I was able to dissect that while going through it. And while I was going through all this, this whole book thing about, the whole book auction and people wanting your book, and the top five came back at me, and it got down to two of the top five publishing houses were like, hey, we want to give you $300,000 for a book advance, and for a first-time author, that's a huge advance.
Yes, it is.
And at that time, I only had like 95,000 followers on Instagram. Now I have 500,000. And that was only 6 months ago. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, for a guy who made like $70,000, $80,000 a year in the military to get a check for $300,000, that's amazing. So I'm sitting there looking at that, and I'm thinking about that, and I'm about to sign this contract. And I had a couple of days, I was back thinking about it. I thought about my life. And I was reflecting back on all the crap I had gone through and all the stuff I had to overcome by myself. And I was like, man, do you really want to sign, Can't Hurt Me? And back then the title was called Built Not Born. And I was like, do you want to sign Can't Hurt Me over? And I was like, no, man, this isn't for sale. I said, man, I don't care if I sell one book. I don't want to give, they're going to get, pretty much 85% of your life. And I was like, no, man, I don't care if I sell one copy.
Well,
so
then you have to answer to other people too, and you're not an answering to other people. You've done that. You've been in the military forever.
Right.
You've been doing a lot of answering. Now you'd rather be the guy questioning and directing rather than answering,
especially about my own personal life.
Exactly.
You know. They can tell me, "Hey, take this out. We don't want this. We don't want that. Don't cuss right here. Don't say this right here." I'm like, you know what, man? You didn't do this. So I'm not gonna, so basically I turned in a major deal and I'm at it alone and I'm self-publishing and this is what I'm doing.
You're gonna kick ass with it. It's gonna be great. And the other part I loved when it's funny, when you were invited to MIT and to be a part of some conference, right? This I can relate to that because this winter I was invited during Boston Marathon time, I was invited to Harvard to come talk about triathlon, right? And I'm like,
right.
I'm going to need a passport. They're not going to let me on a Harvard campus. They're going to check my IQ and say, dude, you're not even allowed in the same zip code.
100%, yes.
So they're inviting David Goggins, who had learning issues, and they're going to invite you to MIT and then have some guy talk about, dealing with pressure and dealing with, with what's your limit of what you can accomplish. Some theorist, right? I'm just guessing that you had a little bit of an issue with that.
You know, what was funny about that, Bob, was so the insecurities, they surfaced, man. Once I walked into MIT, I was like, oh, my God. Because MIT, it's the smartest place to be. In the country.
Right.
Maybe in the daggone world. These people are the best.
They're geniuses.
And, oh, my God. Big time. Everybody on the campus. It's a campus full of geniuses. And I'm in there thinking, my God, man, I just learned how to read, like my junior year pretty much. I had a third grade reading level. And here I am now. They had me on a panel with this guy who was like the all to do with the mind, who studied the mind forever. He's the best. And as he's talking, I'm not agreeing with half the crap he's saying. But I'm sitting there because why? I've actually done it.
Right.
What he's saying, I know a lot of it's true, but this guy must have just, he did a study on normal people.
Right.
And that's what people do. They get their theories off of studies on normal people. They don't study the one percenters and people like that. So I'm sitting there thinking, my God, man, this is true for probably 90% of us. But the way he was talking, he was making it like this is just what it is. And that's what people do to us. Like these really intelligent people and people who aren't even intelligent, They put these bars and these windows on our these ceilings on the human mind. And then we take that ceiling and we take that and we say, okay, this is what we can do. And so as he was talking and a couple other people were talking, I wasn't saying a word. Because first of all, my insecurities surfaced and I didn't want to say a word. I was disagreeing, but I obviously had a look on my face. So someone from the crowd asked me a question. And when someone asked me a question, I'm definitely going to answer it. So I answered the question, and it was totally against what he was saying.
Sure.
But it wasn't in a disrespectful manner. It was in a manner of, that's where I came up with I'm a practitioner.
Yes.
And as a practitioner, I know exactly what the mind is thinking when you were in the worst spot you can possibly be in. And I also know how to get out of that spot. So that's kind of what happened in that situation. I talk about it, in my introduction.
Yes. One of the person to me who's the real hero in this book is your mom. The fact that your mom, Jackie, took you and your brother ended up going back to dad, but you guys, basically she said, we're out of here. We're not going to go through this anymore. If that did not happen, do you think you and your mom would still be alive?
No, because we talked. I think you may have read the chapter. My mom, I talk about my mom. She wanted to kill my father.
Right.
So she wanted to kill him. So I know for a fact someone was going to die.
Right. No question.
Well, yeah, someone was going to die. Either I was going to kill him as I got older, my mom was going to kill him, or my dad was going to kill all of us. You know, I didn't know, because it was so much tension and so much pressure in that house that I just don't know. And I became really tough. And the funny thing about it, I wasn't tough anywhere else growing up, but besides with my father. And, you know, my mom leaving was the thing that probably saved me for sure. My brother ended up going back to my father, and I believe that that messed him up even more.
I'm sure.
And we talk about it in the book. My brother has, he has 9 kids.
Oh, my God.
And his oldest daughter actually got murdered in 2015.
Ugh.
So I talk about that in my book also. My brother, you know, by going back, he has a whole mess of things that happened by going back. But for me, my mom had to work 3 jobs, and she went to school full time. So she was never around, which is why she never saw a report card of mine, which is why I had a 3rd grade reading level while I was able to, you know, to cheat and to get by, because she was never around. So I became a survivor. And, you know, when she was getting ready to get remarried, and she went through a lot, because he ended up getting murdered. So you didn't read this part yet.
Wait, your dad ended up getting murdered?
No, my soon-to-be stepdad got murdered.
Oh, my God.
So that's in the book. So yeah, it just, so you will see here in chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and then, you know, my life just continues to get hit.
Oh.
As I go, just continues to get hit and get hit and get hit. But but through it all, I had to figure out how to look at life differently. I had to find strength and weakness. So I had to find, so I talked about all the insecurity, and you talked about, you know, us leaving. I had to do a lot of soul searching and figure out how to make all this crap work for me. All these insecurities and all this broken foundation, I had to find strength in all of this stuff, and I end up doing it. I end up finding a way to make it work.
It seems like the military was the perfect outlet for you because of the discipline, because of the repetition. Was that why you went that route?
You know what? That's a big reason why I went that route, is I saw all of that. You know, I didn't know then I had a broken foundation. You know, as a kid, you don't know any of that stuff till you look back on your life and you can dissect it with a fine tooth comb. I call it my live autopsy.
Yeah.
You know, when you kind of go back through your life and you can kind of see. But yeah, the military was a place where I had to rebuild a foundation. I had to go into into the hurt locker.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go into a place that they forced you to be very disciplined. And I had to have structure. I had to have all these different things that the military forced upon you. And then I realized that that wasn't even enough for me. I had to even design even more structure, because my foundation was so broken that the military wasn't even enough for me. So, and I found out that, you know, in being judged and in judging yourself so hardly, that I had to do a lot more than just the military, which is why the races became so important, because that built another discipline in my life. So people thought, oh my God, you're Navy SEAL. How many Navy SEALs do you see out there running hundreds of miles and doing pull-up records and stuff? You don't see it.
Nope.
So people always say, oh, you're Navy SEAL, you can do anything. No, that's not the case. It's not the case. Even being a Navy SEAL, and what people think it is, wasn't enough for me. I had to continue to find more of myself. And so the races, the 100-mile races, the pull-up records, I had to find more structure. I had to find more and more structure. And the discipline, it wasn't the races that gave me structure. It was the discipline, the self-discipline I had to have to train for these different events that gave me the even more and more structure.
Was it hard for you, because you come from a background where you really couldn't trust, right? You couldn't trust your own parents, that, and not your mom so much, but your dad, obviously.
Right.
How did that affect you in the military, where you've got to trust that guy next to you with your life? Was that hard for you?
It was very hard for me, because you'll see as you read the book further and further, I wasn't the most liked Navy SEAL. I challenged people. So when you start to develop, so back to the trust thing, I'm getting to it, but
yeah.
When you realize that the mind is unbelievable. So I thought I was the weakest person in the world, but as I started going through life and started realizing how strong the mind is, I started realizing one thing. My God, man, what are we capable of? So I became an animal. I really started becoming a savage. And a lot of people call themselves a savage, but I'm not trying to give myself credit, but I also put myself down a lot in the book, but I also give myself credit when credit is due. I became very, very hard. And there's a lot of mythology behind a lot of different organizations. And one, I challenged people in the SEAL teams, and I got a bad reputation for it, because a lot of people, when you graduate Navy SEAL training, you've made it. You're considered a bad MS.
Yep.
So I saw that for me, what made me a bad man was starting from scratch. Always going back to scratch. So I loved going through the three hell weeks. I loved going to Ranger School being nobody, because at Ranger School, they took away your rank. You were nobody. But in having that kind of mentality, I put that on a lot of people. I put that on a lot of people. Like, man, hey, man, we're supposed to be the best people on the planet, man. We gotta go back to scratch every day. And if I didn't see people doing that, I didn't respect them. And when I would not respect my own teammates. So when it goes back to, that was the issue I had. So you'll see in the book, I talk a lot about stuff like that. A lot of issues about being uncommon. I try to be very uncommon. So about trusting teammates, a lot of that I caused myself. I caused a lot of issues in my life from pushing people way too hard, from having putting my personal demons on them. Sometimes that was it. Sometimes it was expectations I had on people. So it was a lot more than trust, and I didn't trust people on top of that. So it was a lot of it's a lot of lessons learned that happened with the whole trust thing and pushing people too hard and putting expectations on people, because as a Navy SEAL, I believe that we were supposed to do these things. A lot of people aren't David Goggins. A lot of people, so anyway, it all kind of formulated into a lot of different things for me. Trust was one of them.
So, David, when's the book come out?
It comes out December 4, but it's on Amazon right now for pre-order.
Oh, cool.
It is, it's on Amazon now. And actually, what's amazing about that, it went on Amazon around September 6th for pre-order, and there's 1.8 million books around on Amazon. And within the first week, it went to 52 on the Amazon list. Now, so we backed off of kind of getting it out there, but now it's floating around the top 1,000 because we stopped promoting it a lot because we're going to really promote it hard, like around November, December. But right now we're going back into promoting it, man. So, go out there, get a copy of it. It's called Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. And it's a no shit story, man, about my life. I don't bullshit at all. I give you tons of lessons learned. I don't hold back. There's no holds barred. And that's another big thing. If you're not willing to share your life on a billboard and you're hiding who you are and you're hiding secrets about yourself, you're never going to really be able to find out who you are. We hide, so we're so ashamed of who we are, and where we come from, that is our biggest cross, is that we hide from people. That's why social media is so powerful, because what we do on social media is we tell people how great we are. We love telling people how great we are. And in this book, I don't do that.
You never have.
I am brutally honest with who I am and also who I'm not.
So at this point in time, is David Goggins happy in life?
You know what? I'm very happy, but the one thing I like to say about me is I found peace. And a lot of us try to find peace before we go to war with ourselves. I'm a strong believer in that you have to go to war with yourself to find out who you are before you can find peace. And that's what I did. I went to war with myself, whether it be bad or whether it be good. You know, a lot of times it was bad, a lot of times it turned out bad, a lot of times it turned up in horrible situations for me. But in all that, I really found out who David Goggins was, and in finding that, you can find peace.
Was there ever any reach out from your dad to apologize or to say, listen, I was an awful human being, and I've turned over a new leaf? Did any of that ever happen?
So when I was 22 years old, around 22, and I was still big, you know, before I lost the weight to try to be a SEAL, to become a SEAL, I actually went back to Buffalo. So I went back to Buffalo, and I met him because I wanted to make sure before I start. I knew that I had to get some hate out of my life.
Yeah.
I had to start changing. So I had such hatred for this man that I had to go back and face him, you know, man to man. So I went back, and I faced him, and I wanted to see because I saw him through a young kid's eyes.
Right.
And I wanted to make sure, man, I got to see this guy. You know, is what I saw what I saw? You know, was it, you know, because I was now trying to rebuild, like a new foundation, all
sure.
this stuff. So I went back through a 22-year-old man's eyes, and I saw that he was just that guy. And I didn't want that kind of energy in my life, so I forgave him. I mean, we never had like a talk of, you forgive me, I forgive you. I just left knowing he was just a very, very evil man. So I got in the car and I left, and I never saw him again. And I realized that, you know, I don't want him in my life, but I forgave him in my heart. And he ended up dying maybe 2013 or 14. I didn't go to the funeral, but I did forgive him when I was 22 years old, and I moved on. He never said sorry, but in a way, I think he did. After my heart surgery, he actually called my house when I was in San Diego. And he left a message on the answering machine, and I never called him back. But he left a message saying, hey, I heard about your heart. And for him, that's an apology.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
For him, that's an apology. For him, so once again, you have to know your enemy. And I knew for him to pick up the phone, that was an apology.
Very cool. The book is called Can't Hurt Me, Master Your Mind, Defy the Odds. It's written by one of our favorite people on the planet, Mr. David Goggins. The book is available. You can pre-order now on Amazon. It'll be available. So it'll be coming out December 4th, David?
Yeah, it comes out December 4th, but out for pre-order right now on Amazon.
Love it. So we got to get you to San Diego. We'll set up a tri-club meeting and get a couple hundred folks there and have people pre-buy books.
Hey, I love it, man. I will definitely come down, buy books, sign books, whatever, yeah. Man.
Love it. We'll do it. We'll set that up. Again, David Goggins has been our guest. David, I just love chatting with you, man. It's been, like I said, it's been too long watching you from the beginning of this journey and then learning your backstory now. A lot of it really connects. It really makes more sense to me why you were out there doing what you're doing.
Right, right. You know, there's everything comes from something.
Yes. Yeah, that's really true. And it's true. I mean, I've interviewed thousands and thousands of people over the years. And usually tell me your backstory. Very seldom is it my dad beat the crap out of me. That I don't know if that has come out in anybody I've interviewed over the years. So it's pretty eye-opening for me. And like I said, it makes a lot of the other stuff, you know, like we cover running, triathlon, cycling, mountain biking. And that stuff just seems so small when you
right.
talk about the galaxy of what you were dealing with. So
right.
It's
but what's funny
amazing.
About that, Bob, before I let you go, is a lot of people who are out there doing these races.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it.
No,
a lot
you're
of
right.
People, are suffering in a way, and this is how a lot of people get their suffering out.
It's true. You know, it's interesting. We've got two great Ironman triathletes, Sebastian Kienle and Lionel Sanders. Lionel comes from alcohol and drug abuse and turned his life around through the sport of triathlon. And Sebi and Lionel have had battles at these races. And I said to Sebi, what is it like racing Lionel? And he goes, you know, I don't think Lionel cares about winning as much as he does about pushing himself to the point where he's hurting himself. And you can't break someone like that. Someone who's out there for a different, and that just, when I was thinking back to that interview, and now that reminds me of you. If someone's racing you, they're not going to break David Goggins because you're not out there to win the race. You're out there to break David Goggins.
That is the truest statement I've heard in my life. And that's when I realized, I told you before, early in the conversation, when I started racing the person beside me is when I started doing bad.
Right. Yeah.
If I kept it within myself, and like you said, that's when people have a hard time with me. A hard time with me.
Love it. David Goggins has been our guest. And again, we're brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, by Polar, Chase Your Destiny, PremiumPlus-Sports.com, best travel agency around. If you haven't tried a swim run event, grab a partner and go to USA-SwimRun.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, this year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on BabbittVille.com or on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.